Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Crown Encrozure. I'm your host, Patrick Brown. Since his death on December 31st, 2022, there have been countless tributes paid to Pope Benedict XVI, extolling his legacy as one of the greatest minds and shepherds of the contemporary church. In this episode, we aim to add our own tribute into the mix by focusing on what were arguably the most significant contributions made by the late pontiff to Catholicism's understanding of the relationship between the church and the state. In particular, we turn attention to a set of speeches which Benedict delivered during his pontificate within the walls of some of the most iconic halls of power in Europe, namely Westminster Hall in London, England in 2010, and the German Parliament, or Bundestag, in 2011. During these speeches, the late Holy Father tackled head-on the most essential questions pertaining to how we organize our life in common, including what constitutes the foundation of Western civilization, what is the role of truth and justice in public life, how natural law can anchor public discourse, and what a true ecology of man looks like. Our guest for this discussion is Father Raymond D'Souza. Father Raymond is one of North America's most well-known Catholic commentators, with columns regularly appearing in the National Post and the National Catholic Register. He also serves as a parish priest in the Archdiocese of Kingston, Ontario. Thanks for listening in. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us a rating, or hit us up on social media. Please enjoy this installment of the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant at God's first.
Father Raymond D'Souza, welcome back to Crown Crozier.
Thank you, Patrick. Good to be with you again.
It's been about 2 months since the death of Pope Benedict XVI, and rightfully so, fittingly so, there have been countless number of tributes paid to one of the greatest minds and shepherds in the contemporary church. For today, we thought we'd try to put our own spin on things in terms of a tribute, add our own value, and focus on what were arguably the singular, unique contributions of the late pontiff to Catholicism's understanding of the relationship between the church and state. If you don't mind, though, before we turn to that topic of hand, I'd like to back up and perhaps just ask you for some personal reflections on the life and legacy of Pope Benedict and what his pontificate, what his example, what his corpus of teaching has meant for you and your priesthood.
I was ordained in 2002, and for people who are ordained in my time, Cardinal Ratzinger's writings had become quite influential in the 1990s. His interview books had come out. By that time, largely Ignatius Press was printing a lot of his books in English. And so I studied in Rome, so he was there. I mean, I didn't have any personal relationship with him, but he'd be around giving conferences and so forth. So he was influential. I think a little bit less so than those priests who came after me when he was actually Pope. You know, John Paul was still Pope when I was there. So that was a, his writings had an enormous impact, especially on one of the most important fields for priests, which is biblical theology, which is very important for preaching, obviously. And he really, that might be his greatest legacy, is restoring biblical theology to the life of ordinary priests and even to, if you want to say, the ordinary lay faithful to be able to get access to the Bible and good scholarship about the Bible. That was one of his most important accomplishments. You know, in the English-speaking world, I think probably Scott Hahn and his school have done an enormous amount of work on that, practically speaking, getting resources into hands of people. But at the universal level, certainly Benedict made a big influence there. I would say as a journalist, he was very interesting as well, because although he was always said to be a shy scholar, he was a kind of interesting shy scholar in that he insisted at all times in his life that the world know what he thought. from his early days, writing, you know, rather major speeches about the Second Vatican Council, founding a journal right after the council to, you know, continue the discussion. As a professor, being very prolific in his interventions, not just on scholarly topics, but broad topics. And then when he became prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome, he insisted that he be allowed to publish his own private scholarly works, which John Paul allowed him to do, which is in general a bad idea, by the way, for a prefect of the dicastery to do that. But Ratzinger was determined always that his voice had to be heard. So he was a shy, retiring personality, but he was not a humble scholar in the sense of saying that my views don't need to be heard. And then he pioneered, really, the interview book. Now everybody and his dog does interview books. I think Pope Francis has done over 10 of them. It's astonishing. It's the number he's done. But it was Ratzinger who pioneered that in 1985 with the Ratzinger Report. And then he did, I think, 4 or 5 books with Peter Sewald, which was his way of saying that it's very important for the world to know what I think about almost every topic in the life of the church. So, and as a journalist, that was fascinating. And even after he retired, when he said, I'm going to disappear, you're not going to hear from me before, he did another interview book, you know, so, and he continued to write, you know, forewords and things like that. So, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if, you know, 10 years after his death, there's some book that he wanted. He already released one that came out in January of things he wanted published after he died. And if there's more, it wouldn't surprise me. So as a journalist, he was a fascinating figure because although he was enormously learned and spoke at a very high level of sophistication and also very great depth of profound analysis, he wanted his voice to be heard by the general public. And he insisted on that his whole time. And it was one of his most important things, because a lot of people learn from Ratzinger Benedict through his books, through his interviews. And then most remarkably, as Pope, he wrote 3 books in a private capacity. I don't know if that's ever been done. Also probably not a good idea in general for a Pope to write books of private theology. But he insisted, again, his views on biblical scholarship should be known, his private views. And so, you know, a very interesting figure, always thought to be conservative, but actually quite radical and even a bit reckless, you might say, in his public interventions, not in the quality of them, but in the quantity and scope of where he decided to speak. And so for me, as a priest, as a student of the scriptures, and as a journalist, he was really a towering figure. And I read him all the time, and I profited always from it. So I'm very grateful.
Within that large corpus of the late Holy Father's work and teachings and thoughts, a few things stand out, one subset of which is what's become or what has become to be known as his September addresses, a series of lectures that he delivered during the month of September in different venues across Europe from the years 2006 to 2011. For today's purposes, we're interested specifically on the latter two addresses, namely in Westminster Hall in London and then in the German Parliament in Berlin. But perhaps, maybe just as a preamble or a preface, if you could set the scene for us, what was your sense of what prompted Pope Benedict to deliver these addresses? What were the recurring themes and unifying threads? And what do you think inspired him?
Well, he had trips most Septembers of his pontificate, not every single one, but, and he kept the practice that John Paul and others had before him. He spent the summer months at Castel Gandolfo with a schedule of fewer appointments. So I think he had time to draft these major addresses, looking forward to the September trips. That's another example. He liked to give the lecture. The magisterial lecture was part of his professorial background. It doesn't always fit well into a pontificate because a magisterial lecture takes account of different arguments and can sometimes raise provocative questions that might create a bit of a disturbance, which is what happened after the most famous of these September speeches in Regensburg in 2006. But I started drawing attention to them some years ago, and I've been lecturing on them probably the last 10 years, so I'm very delighted you're taking up this topic. I think you had George Weigel on your podcast recently. And in so George and I teach every summer together in Krakow, and I've been giving the September speeches address there to the students for many years. And he put a version of that in his latest book, when he talks about Benedict's thinking. So on church-state questions, Benedict did not address them in a formal fashion with an encyclical or an apostolic letter so much, but he used these addresses. And so there were four of them. In Regensburg in 2006, he basically argued that faith needs the world of reason to prevent faith from becoming falling into excesses, and particularly the excess of violence in the name of God. And that was done under the backdrop of Islamic violence, which created the uproar. But Benedict actually argued from Christian history that if we lose sight of the role of reason, faith can fall into errors. 2 years later in Paris, he argued that the world of faith, especially the study of the monks, produces a culture of the word. So study of languages, study of history, the art of translation, even the artistic disciplines of producing manuscripts and so forth, gives rise to a culture that is of service beyond the world of religion. So in a certain sense, he says the world of reason and culture needs the horizon of faith. The next two addresses, the ones you're interested in 2010, he went to Westminster Hall. So that was the visit he made to Great Britain. It was an unusual visit because he had taken up the decision not to do beatifications himself. John Paul did beatifications and canonizations himself. Benedict decided to return to an earlier practice. But he made an exception for John Henry Newman. He went to Birmingham to beatify him himself. And they built a visit around that beatification. And one of the highlights of it was that he was invited to speak in Westminster Hall. That's the most ancient part of the Palace of Westminster. Very few people get to speak there. Before Benedict, I think the last one was Nelson Mandela, and before him, Charles de Gaulle. So it's not something that's very regular, although I think now it's become a little bit more common. And most dramatically, from a historical point of view, that was the place in which, in 1535, the trial of Thomas More was held. Trials are not held there anymore, but at that time they were. So there's a plaque on the ground. I was very blessed. I was there for that occasion. There's a plaque on the ground that says, here took place the trial of Thomas More, and Benedict saw that. And then 2011, he returned to his third trip to Germany, and he spoke in the German parliament, the Bundestag. It used to be called the Reichstag. It's not called that anymore for reasons of Nazi-era memories. And he addressed a very profound question for Germans and German Christians, is what do you make about the power of the state and the role of law in a country which knows very well the brutality of tyranny? So in those two addresses at Westminster and at the Bundestag, he outlined some of his key principles. I'm a great admirer of the September speeches because they're speeches and not long documents. People can read them quite easily. He delivered them in half an hour or 40 minutes. So, and they give a real insight into the issues that, 21st century people interested in faith and politics, reason and politics, law and faith, all these kinds of questions. So
let's pick on some of those themes and kind of take the latter two speeches one by one, starting in Westminster Hall with the 2010 visit. Of the four September speeches, that was the one that zeroed in a little more succinctly on the role of religion in public life. I think there was actually an instance in the speech where Pope Benedict asked what may have been a rhetorical, what may have been a very practical question. In our contemporary politics, would we even have a place for someone like St. Thomas More anymore? Would he be welcome? Would someone of religious moral conviction, someone with religiously informed perspectives, is there even a place for that type of individual anymore? In conjunction with that, he also talked about religion not being a problem, but actually being something that is a solution, something that can contribute to the national conversation. So could you perhaps tell us a little bit more and what he was getting at in that regard?
Well, I'm going to challenge your premise a bit there, Patrick, because there wasn't a place for Thomas More in the 1600s.
Mm.
That's the whole point. He was executed. There was no place for Thomas More. And Thomas More was a very lonely figure, and most people thought that he was wrong to do what he did, and there wasn't a place for him. So people who look at history and say, well, you know, in 1535, there are people like Thomas More around, and today we wouldn't have room for him. Well, actually, it'd be hard to be a Thomas More in Canada or the United Kingdom today because you couldn't be executed. It's against the law, right? So there are no martyrs. There will be no martyrs in the United Kingdom or in Canada at the hands of the state because capital punishment is eliminated, right? So you can't be a martyr. There's no Thomas More for 2023. And in fact, today, I would say that even people who feel a bit beleaguered about the shrinking space, if you want to say, for Christian witness, which was certainly a theme of Benedict's visit to Great Britain, it's fine to lament that and to critique it more than just lament it. But the lesson of Thomas More tells us is that in history, this time is, there were much more fearsome times. So fierce was the persecution under Henry that most Catholics of the time, acceded to Henry's demands, as you know. I would say one of the key things about the visit to 2010 and the Westminster Address was that Benedict argued there for a willingness to leave space. He wasn't arguing for a theocracy. He said, but there's a religious wisdom. It's a source of ethics and moral guidance. It exists independent of the actual statutory law. It exists independent of the current, whatever the current configuration of political parties is. And it would be foolish to exclude this wisdom from public debate. He didn't say that it has to prevail. He just said it's foolish to exclude it. And actually, I think one of the most important parts of that speech, which today in 2023 is much more important than it was in 2010 when he delivered it. The opening paragraphs, he speaks about moderation. He says that in this British Parliament, he said, you have a tradition of moderation. It's not a revolutionary political culture. I mean, they've had revolutions, but it's not a revolutionary culture. It's not the French Revolution. It's not the Russian Revolution. It's not the National Socialist Revolution. And he said that spirit of moderation, of leaving room for the other person, of listening and coming to a compromise, he said is very noble. And boy, do we ever need to hear that today, because many people today in democracies, including ours in Canada, think of moderation as a kind of a dirty word. And partly it's the technology and the way we communicate, but there's a big move towards extremism, or to take the most extreme position. And that instinct for moderation, I think, is a very, it's very relevant today, because if you have public arguments, and this is one of the problems with religiously formed public arguments, that was what he talked about in Regensburg, is that they tend to get formulated into absolute categories, which leaves very little room for political negotiation or resolution. And in its worst case, leads to violence. It doesn't always lead to violence, but it can. So I would say that the message of Westminster was, you have a moderate political culture. You work things out in Parliament. You avoid extremes. And that's to your credit. And it's actually immoderate and outside of your history to exclude religious arguments just on that ground. And then he made a specific example. He didn't speak too much about Thomas More. He just mentioned him in passing, by the way. But he made an example. He made a reference to the example of the debates in the British Parliament in the early part of the 19th century about the slave trade, about slave trade first and then slavery. That was argued in Parliament, and it was Christians, William Wilberforce, the most famous of them, who made the arguments there that eventually prevailed. And although he didn't say it, very much in the background would be that the British way of eliminating slavery, abolishing slavery, through debate, through listening to political and religious arguments, not excluding religious arguments, was a much more humane and effective way of doing it than the American example, which is through war, right? In a very brutal war. And in fact, the brutality of the war, civil war in the United States, to abolish slavery, meant that those on the losing side, they had to give in on the slavery question, but they gave in grudgingly, and you have another 100 years from 1863 to 1963, from the Emancipation Proclamation to Martin Luther King at the Lincoln Memorial, of not slavery, but racial discrimination embedded in law. So Benedict in Westminster was saying, don't exclude sources of wisdom. Don't exclude religion, which brings wisdom to your public debates. It's not moderate to do that, and you have a proud tradition of moderation. And if you look at the examples of which you're most proud of in British parliamentary history, of which the abolition of the slave trade would be one, you can see that making room for religious arguments was to your advantage. So that was, I think, the main argument that he put before the Westminster Parliament. And then he said, if you see today a tendency to exclude religion from all aspects of public life, you're making a mistake. And hence he said, religion is not a problem that needs to be solved.
Correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't there an aspect too of linking the merit or the basis for some religious arguments and acknowledging them perhaps as a mirror of other arguments that could be made motivated by a different set of perspectives or principles, and the linkage there being natural law, and natural law being a vocabulary or a grammar around which people of goodwill can coalesce and can serve as a basis for debate without necessarily having to draw on religious principles, which may be the purview of believers or who might alienate other people, but looking to the natural law as a bridge in that regard.
Right? That's fine. That's actually the Bundestag address, not okay. So much the Westminster address, but at the Bundestag, Benedict argued, he said, you know, Christianity never had a code of political or legal principles. He said other religious traditions have had it. You know, for us Christians, we're most familiar with, say, the regulation of political and social life that you find in the, you know, the Pentateuch, you know, very specific regulations on, you know, even how disputes are to be heard. Christianity never had that. It had principles, but it always left the working out of political settlements and a legal code to the world of philosophy that could be informed by those principles. And that's the argument he makes very clearly at the Bundestag. At Westminster, what he did there, along the lines you're suggesting, Patrick, was he used the recent example of the financial crisis. And he said, look, this is 2010, so, and you know, London is in some ways even more of a world financial center than New York is.
Sure.
Financial crisis was a very big problem there. And he said, you know, isn't it the case that looking back on the financial crisis, people say, you know, the problem there was that key moral and ethical principles were abandoned. Fraud or a lack of virtue. There's no prudence, excessive risk, or even, lying about risk. I mean, he didn't go into all that, but he said the financial crisis taught us that even secular people would say, you know, there's something was off ethically, morally, and led to this crisis. And so then he said, well, if that's the case in the world of economics and finance, why wouldn't that also be the case in politics? If we exclude our ethical and moral foundation, doesn't have to obviously be a Catholic one, but if we exclude those arguments, we might have the same negative result. So he made an economic finance analogy in Westminster. We'll see in the Bundestag, he made an ecological analogy there.
Let's turn attention to the Bundestag address in 2011. When he went to the Bundestag, it was his third trip to his home and native land, Germany. Perhaps just maybe speak to that into the context in terms of what it means. I mean, we often talk about, in our tradition, a prophet not necessarily being received well in his homeland or in his hometown. How was he received?
The two visits were similar. By that time, there had whipped up a very, very vigorous opposition to Pope Benedict in many of the European capitals. There was a campaign of months of vilification and condemnation before he went to Great Britain. It was really quite unusual in its intensity. And that's why when the Pope got there and Her Late Majesty received him very graciously, and his addresses were received graciously, including Westminster Hall. At the end of it, David Cameron said, the Prime Minister at the time, when he left, he said, "You know, you've really made us stop and think." I mean, it was what had been thought of as going to be some great political kind of conflict turned into an opportunity to reflect. So that was the background even to Westminster or to the Great Britain visit. In Germany, he had been back right away after his election for World Youth Day in Cologne. That's the cultural capital of Germany. Then he'd gone back in 2006 to his home, to Bavaria, to Regensburg, and to Munich. But this third trip in 2011 was to the political Germany, to Berlin. Again, there was that hostility. Does this religious man have anything to say to us? And in fact, in the German federal parliament, the Green Party, which I think at that time represented about a sixth of the seats, so not insignificant, you know, about 16-17% of the seats, said that it was outrageous that he should even be invited to speak, even though, you know, the idea that a German pope would not be welcome to speak in the German parliament seems to just lack good manners. But they boycotted the speech. So there was that kind, there was hostility. Now, that being said, the chancellor, the speaker, I mean, he got a very beautiful, gracious reception at the parliament. There was no hostility from the authorities who invited him, but there was 15% or so who boycotted the, 17% boycotted the talk. So there was this question about whether a mature, democratic, secular Germany needed to listen to what a religious figure, even a very great religious figure, like the Pope of Rome, or in this case, Benedict Ratzinger, son of Germany, had to say. So that was the background to it. In that sense, you know, we're recording this in the, you know, not long after his death, not long before the 10th anniversary of Pope Francis and so forth. And people have very short memories. People say lament that, you know, that the church is very polarized and there's a lot of debate and conflict, which is not only true, but also can be regrettable. But, you know, Pope Francis has never had a trip like the lead up to a trip like Benedict had for Westminster and for Great Britain and for Germany. So, you know, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, these things, these high octane conflicts were prevailing. And Germany was, at least in the Bundestag part of it, was part of that. But he went there. And of course, that place, I've never been to Berlin, so I've not seen the building. But people who have say that the very architecture of Berlin has the echoes of the Nazi period. You know, the Reichstag was burned down. When they rebuilt it specifically with those memories in mind. They have the Great Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. And of course, the history of Germany after the war was about reconstruction. So apparently, you know, even the physical architecture, I'm told by people who have been there, evokes those memories. So Benedict arrives, and he gets right to the point, and he built his talk in the Bundestag around the Prayer of Solomon for wisdom, for a listening heart. You know, it's his way of saying that the wise ruler wants a listening heart to listen for wisdom. And wisdom is not only what we can manufacture or agree on, but wisdom opens us up to a greater tradition. Of course, he's speaking about the religious tradition. And then he puts the question very bluntly. He said, look, we're in a parliament. And most of what the Nazi regime did was legal. They came to power in a parliament. You know, they didn't stage a revolution in the streets and, you know, seize power in a coup d'etat. They were elected. They passed laws. Some of the laws that we think of as most notorious now were laws. That means they were passed through a democratic parliament. They were not diktats of an authoritarian. Eventually, of course, especially during the war years, that broke down. But his question is that what do we say about laws then? We're standing in a place where we Germans know that duly elected parliaments passing duly promulgated laws can produce great evil. So what does that tell us? And then he says, he quotes St. Augustine and, you know, his preferred theological thinker. And of course, Augustine did, unlike Benedict, devote a lot of his attention to church and state questions and the questions of justice, questions of social order. And he quotes probably the most famous line of St. Augustine in regard to politics is that without justice, what is the state but a great gang of robbers, of thieves? If you don't have justice, it doesn't matter how good your democratic procedures are. It doesn't matter how careful your judicial institutions are. If you don't have justice that governs everything, the state is a great gang of robbers. And, you know, I mentioned earlier Martin Luther King. You know, that was the argument Martin Luther King made. And he was a Baptist, not a Catholic. And at the height of his civil rights struggle, he said, look, St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine taught us that a law that is not just is not a law. And that formed the basis of Benedict's argument, the Bundestag. He said, it's not enough. And we, above all Germans, and above all in this place, realize that if a law does not correspond to some external standard of justice, it doesn't matter if it's procedurally legitimate, because it can be doing a great evil. And that's the argument he made there. And there are a few places in the world where it could resonate more. And obviously that this was a man. Remember, when he's speaking there, he's someone whose own father had to leave his job because he was against the Nazi regime. He had to give up his job. He had to move to another city. Now, in the scheme of Nazi persecutions, that was not a great one. But you know, you're a family man. You have to leave your job. That's not an insignificant thing. And of course, both Joseph Ratzinger and his brother Georg, towards the end of the war, you know, the Catholic youth groups were conscripted into the Nazi youth. So he had some personal experience of that regime.
A couple of other themes I want to make sure we touch on. They're linked in a way because they have to do with remembering our history and recognizing our true nature, not just as societies, but as individuals. But as societies, it seemed like a focus for Pope Benedict and the Bundestag was, let's remember our heritage and let's remember what got us here as a leading member of the nations of Western civilization. And he drew attention to the interlocking influences, if you will, of Jerusalem, Athens, and Rome, and the distinct contributions and places for those three entities within the Western tradition, of which Germany was one of many inheritors. Could you perhaps speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, he didn't say it. First of all, I should make a general comment on all four addresses. You really see what a beautiful rhetorician Joseph Ratzinger and Benedict was. These are beautifully crafted addresses. You know, I might sound like I'm hammering some points here and there. He never sounds like that. You know, it's a very gift. It's an example of his great gift. Ratzinger, his whole life, took a rather stronger view than some in the Christian tradition about the providential meeting, as you point out, Patrick, between biblical religion, that is the Hebrew tradition, God's revelation to Abraham, to Moses, etc., culminating in Jesus Christ. That meeting with the world of Greek philosophy, you mentioned Athens, so the fact that the church eventually, St. John uses a term like the Logos to explain who Jesus is. At the Council of Nicaea, they use the terms of Greek philosophy to explain the Trinity. And then, of course, the move of the church, the Mother Church of Jerusalem, moves actually to Rome in the apostolic period. And Ratzinger would argue, which is not required to believe this as a Catholic, but he said that that's just not accidents of history. He was very strong that the encounter of biblical religion, Jerusalem, with Greek philosophy, the world of reason, Athens, was part of God's providential plan for revelation. That's a very, very strong statement. Not everybody would agree with him on that, but he did. He pushed that point quite far, and he said, actually, it's not possible to imagine that Jerusalem meeting some other tradition would have been just as fine. So that was a very key part of his thought all along, and he made that argument very strongly in the Bundestag. He said, look, what Europe is, and Germany belongs to Europe, Germany is at the heart of Europe. It's impossible to imagine Europe without Germany, not just geographically, but as a cultural reality, Germany is at the heart of Europe. And Europe is the biblical faith of Israel, fulfilled in Jesus Christ, meeting the world of reason out of Greek philosophy, and being ordered by the heritage of Roman law. That's what Europe is. And if you remove those things, Europe fails in its mission, and Europe falls into a crisis. And although it was left unsaid in 2011, they're looking back over 100 years where Germany was involved in two major wars, the largest wars, you know, imaginable, and in evils that even today are hard to comprehend, you know, which the Holocaust has the most biblical resonance, right? The Holocaust of the Jewish people. And so he said, that's what's at stake. That's what's at stake. And that don't think that you can take this tripartite cultural heritage and remove parts of it and presume that things will proceed or even flourish. He said, actually, quite to the contrary. And in Germany, not just, during the Nazi period, but even today, there are those who say, well, that Jerusalem part, that biblical religious part, should be excluded. And today, even in 2011 when he was there, there's also a constituency that says maybe the reason part should be excluded, and you're left really just with law, but that's the whole point. He said, if you're only left with law, he said, the problem in the 1930s in Germany in the Reichstag was not a lack of law. There was plenty of law. But if you only have your law and you've excluded your philosophical reason, your theological wisdom, your society is in deep trouble. And that message, you know, we would, if you think about Canada in 2023, there are no shortage of voices who would say, we shouldn't have that, you know, the Jerusalem, the biblical tradition doesn't have a place in our public life. And even reason maybe doesn't have a place in our public life. Now, the stakes around us today are not as dramatic as they were in the 1930s in Germany. But the warning is good to heed lest they become so. I mean, we're in a different historical moment. It's not the same. But the argument there has its applications beyond Germany, obviously.
Sure. If you remove Jerusalem and biblical revelation from the equation, it's not just about how we understand ourselves as a civilization, but how we understand ourselves as individuals and as persons. And his address at the parliament, he riffed on that for a moment, and he wrapped it up in this concept of the ecology of man. Could you fill in the blanks for us a little bit there?
Well, he had, in Westminster, London, the great financial capital, he had made a comparison, you know, basically said, if there's rules of the economic order and of finance that you violate at your peril, are there not also rules of the political order that you violate at your peril? Rules of human dignity that you violate at your peril? In Germany, he used a different example. He said, in Germany, we're very proud of our ecological sensibility. Now, this, he was actually, I mean, popes don't usually trash talk, and Benedict rarely trash talked, but he was doing a bit of that because he chose the example, and he said in his talk, I'm not trying to choose any partisan, I'm not speaking to any partisan group, which is what you say when you're speaking exactly to a partisan group. Yeah. He was speaking to the Greens. They weren't there.
Who were absent, yeah.
And basically what he was saying is, okay, he said, so the Greens, who don't even want to listen to me, the Green Party, I mean, not all environmentalists, but the Green Party didn't want to listen to me, they represent this ecological sensitivity of which Germans are very proud. And he said, but how can it be that there's an ecology, rules of the natural world that must be respected, and if they're violated, bad things happen? How can it be that the human person who's part of the natural world cannot also have rules about his dignity and his rights that if they're violated, bad things happen? And he used the term there, if we're defending natural ecology, and we're very proud of that as Germans, he said, what about human ecology? Isn't there an ecology of the human person and human society? That term, to my knowledge, first appeared, I think, in Gentesimus Annus of 1991, which was John Paul's encyclical on social doctrine. Maybe it came from Ratzinger. He would have been involved in drafting that. Obviously, he was prefect of the CDF at the time. That term was there, human ecology. Ratzinger, Benedict returned to it more often, and certainly at the Bundestag he spoke about it. He said, look, if we're going to respect the natural order, we should respect human ecology. And that's one theme that Pope Francis has really taken up. He uses that term, human ecology, integral human ecology. You know, in Laudato Si, his encyclical on the environment, he speaks about, well, if you're making an impassioned plea to respect the natural order, how can you then say that there's nothing about the human order that needs to be respected, right? And so, and that famous phrase of Pope Francis, the throwaway society, he said, well, you know, if you shouldn't throw away the bounty of the natural world, just use it up and throw it away, how can you possibly say we can take human lives after they're used up, quote, or not desired and throw them away? So, but that part was probably one of the few times where Benedict was deliberately provocative. I mean, he was speaking to that. He chose that example because of the protests before there. But it's a very powerful example today, Patrick, because many people are very passionate about ecological matters. And there's certainly a very long and strong Christian tradition of passion, moral passion for ecological matters. It goes back many centuries. And therefore, the role of human ecology in that is it's a persuasive way to make the case. And you see Benedict, the great teacher here, when he's in London, he says, okay, finance is very important to you, let me talk about finance. When he's in Berlin, he says, ecology is very important to you, let me talk about ecology.
Yeah, he knows his audience well. Kind of wrapping this all up, we regularly hear how people of faith in our Western North American context, certainly Christians seem to be on the receiving end of this criticism more than other denominations, but how people of faith in the public square shouldn't be allowed to, quote unquote, impose their views or impose their morality on others in the context of politics and lawmaking. And I'm just wondering, the example, the witness, the legacy of these September speeches, is that kind of an effective rebuttal on its own to that flawed way of thinking? Is it too simplistic to say that the richness of what Pope Benedict put on the table to his British and his German audiences, it essentially neutralizes the argument that religion has nothing to offer? Is that too simplistic a takeaway, or how would you respond to that?
Well, I think there's a few lessons you can make there. I mean, he makes the theoretical or conceptual case, both in Westminster and in the Bundestag, about why it's not sensible, it's not reasonable to exclude religious arguments and the religious patrimony of those cultures from common deliberations or deliberations about the common good. He makes that case. So that answers that question on a conceptual framework. He points out contemporary and historical examples where actually either religious arguments were beneficial to the common good and widely recognized as such, or the exclusion of religion turned out to be catastrophic, also by common consensus. So he does that. So in that way, the September speeches do answer that criticism. But he makes it very clear, especially in the Bundestag address, that the Catholic faith is not a political system. And we have to appeal to reason. And therefore, even Catholics may disagree on some points of how things should be organized politically. So certainly it answers in that way. But I think also, The September speeches show us a manner of doing this. Now, we have very few people who are as intelligent or as refined as Pope Benedict was, and we have very few popes, right? Only one at a time. So it's not like this is easily replicated, you know? Sure, you can't. Sure. And even some of the great addresses that John Paul gave before political audiences at the UN or at the Italian Parliament or the Polish Parliament, you know, they weren't of the same quality as Benedict's. So it's not something that can be replicated. We may not live long enough to ever see it done again. But the manner in which he would make arguments, and really in both places, there was such hostility, but he was disarming because he didn't raise his voice. He didn't shout. He just stood there and spoke in his very soft, professorial manner, but with conviction and also with a certain deference and kindness to his hosts. And I think that's a good model. You know, it goes a bit back to what I was saying about the tradition of moderation. But if religious arguments are to be heard, you know, if they come across in a guise of denunciation or hostility, if someone is shouting at you, no matter how wise what he's shouting is, you may be reluctant to hear it. And that's a challenge for religious people today for two reasons. One is that the environment in which we are kind of rewards shouting, right? There's a lot of shouting going on, and religious media organizations are not immune from that. If you want to attract an audience, it's easier to attract one with shouting than with, you know, serene disquisitions on topics. That's just a reality. And so everybody in media, Catholic or otherwise, has that challenge. But it's a particular challenge in the religious world. And then also, if you're feeling on the beleaguered end of things, if you feel that your society is turning a bit against you, then it's easier to give in to that desire to shout back. But Benedict was a persuader, and he was very persuasive. So it's also a good model for how to engage public affairs, I think.
Well, I think that's a great capstone to our conversation. You've given us a lot to reflect on. Thank you for being part of this tribute to the legacy of the late Holy Father, Father Raymond D'Souza. Always a pleasure. Really appreciate your time.
Good. God bless your good work, Patrick. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.